This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency with information for IT professionals. For more information and to download other shows, visit ciaops.podbean.com. This is episode 24 with Troy Hunt and is brought to you by the Computer Information Agency. Visit us on the web at www.ciaops.com. Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and for this episode, I'm joined by Troy Hunt. Troy, welcome.
G'day, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
No problems. Excellent to have a familiar Australian accent. So welcome along here. So as we normally do here on the Need to Know podcast, the first thing I'll ask you to do is just to introduce yourself to our audience. Let us firstly know who you are, what you do, and again, any areas of specialty that you've got.
Yeah, sure, Robert. So I'm a software architect. So my specialty is around particularly web applications. I've been building web apps since the very early days, so probably around mid-90s. I currently oversee software architecture at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals Emerging Markets. I'm a very regular blogger, particularly around security at troyhunt.com. I am also the author of the free ebook, the OWASP Top 10 for .NET Developers book, and I'm the creator of A Safer Web, the automated security analyzer for ASP.NET web applications, and I'm a Microsoft MVP for developer security.
Excellent. Well, there's certainly a lot of hats you're wearing there, and I think that obviously working for a business as large as Pfizer, Is that a challenge working in the security, in the security environment?
Well, it's interesting. So my work at Pfizer is more general architecture, and the security is something that's really become more of a personal specialty. I think having sort of a deep interest in the mechanisms of how software works, and particularly having seen a lot of the goings on that we see on the web lately around breaches. So certainly that's something that I bring to me in my job at Pfizer. And as you can imagine, something like security is of course, very important to a company like Pfizer.
So what made you, want to get into the security space? I mean, look, it is a very interesting area, but, what's your sort of, your driving reason to get involved in that?
Well, I think the catalyst for me was I would often talk to developers about security. So that may have been developers that I work with directly or developers at vendors. And what I would often find is that we talk to developers about the OWASP Top 10. So OWASP is the Open Web Application Security Project. It's an open not-for-profit foundation that sets forth a set of vulnerabilities or security risks, if you like, which they call the Top 10. Now, the top 10 are things like cross-site scripting and SQL injection, which probably sound pretty familiar to people. And OWASP do a great job of outlining these security risks and prioritizing them by their prevalence. Now, the thing about OWASP is that they're a technology-agnostic organization. So when they talk about something like injection, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to give you a lot of guidance about how you prevent injection attacks in a .NET application. So I saw a little bit of a gap there and decided that what I wanted to do is embark on this endeavor, which ended up taking about a year and a half to go through and really heavily document each one of those top 10 for the Microsoft .NET technology stack. And that's what really started to lead me deeper into that security path, because the more I delved into it, the more interesting it became, particularly when I wanted to actually demonstrate risks. So I wanted to demonstrate the risk, for example, of not using SSL/TLS for a secure transfer of data. So what does it actually look like to sniff packets on a wireless network and break people's authentication schemes when they don't have HTTPS? So I just sort of, started erring down that track and gained a lot of momentum, and it's all happened at a time when we've had lots of very high-profile breaches as well. So it's been a little bit opportune for me, I think, Robert.
So would you say that your interest is mainly around the application security or, the range of security, so firewalls, intrusions, that sort of stuff? Do you limit yourself to one or the other, or are you looking at security as an all-encompassing field?
Look, I think you've got to look at it as a bit all-encompassing. Certainly my specialty is more on the application side of things. And I think the interesting thing is as well that the majority of vulnerabilities or exploits we see are actually happening at the application side. And there's certainly some interesting figures out there around something in the order of about 80% of vulnerabilities or breaches are happening at the application tier. And conversely, what I find is very interesting is IT budgets normally go the other way. So we're normally seeing IT budgets for security predominantly around that infrastructure tier, so around our firewalls, around our networks. And we're not seeing an awful lot of money spent on the application security side of things as an industry.
Okay, so is that something that is a factor of a management decision, or is it just that the features come first? Or, I mean, you know, if security is obviously, you know, an important thing, and we see plenty of examples of issues on the news and those sort of things, I mean, why isn't the money being spent, do you think?
Look, I think part of it is probably, you know, putting my business hat on for a moment, they're not looking at security as a feature or deliverable. It's sort of an implied asset, I guess, of the application, probably in the same way that performance is. So if I was to talk to somebody who wanted software built, they would say, you know, I want you to be able to log in, and I want you to be able to watch this video and upload these files and social media, this and that. They don't normally talk about security, and there's an expectation that it is an implicit requirement, and it's probably a fair enough expectation as well. But as a result, it doesn't seem to get much attention until things go really wrong, and then suddenly everybody's willing to throw money at it and fix things in a very rapid fashion.
So would it be fair to say that is it something that is being ignored, or is it something that's just being minimized, do you think?
Look, I think it's something that is very frequently an afterthought. So it's interesting watching discussions, and there was a very good one recently on LinkedIn where they said, look, when do you normally think about security as developers? And a lot of people said, look, we think about it once we've had a breach. Okay, so once things have gone wrong, then suddenly it's very, very important. I think, again, if we sort of tie it back to that performance paradigm, when people are building applications, the performance of, say, the database or the performance of the assets over the network from the web page, I think everybody knows that these are sort of things that should happen, but we very often see them neglected. Now, of course, unlike performance, when things go wrong, security rise, that things can go wrong very drastically, and things can go wrong quite irreversibly, and we've seen that happen in a number of cases recently. So it just doesn't seem to have a high enough profile early on. But I do have a bit of a sense that maybe that is starting to change, I think, as a result of the activities that we've seen probably over the last year or 18 months.
So I suppose that given that most people are probably in the small to smaller to medium area, I mean, in your experience, what do you consider the major threat to their IT business? You know, so they're typically a small business running a single server, doing internet banking, have a website, sending emails, having staff browse the web, running a few standard apps, a few custom apps. Do you think that they would be most vulnerable generally?
Well, there's a few different angles we can come at this at. So one angle, probably not so much related to the application security, is password reuse. So we have seen examples, and in fact, HB Gary is a good example. So HB Gary was a application security specialist firm that got exposed in rather spectacular style a little while back. And the way the attackers managed to get into their system, certainly some of the doors they opened were from password reuse. So they would grab the password, which was poorly secured in one location, and they'd re-leverage that in another location. So having a password policy and a password practice which actively discourages reuse is a really critical thing, because otherwise the thing becomes a bit like a skeleton key. You know, it gets you into everywhere. And particularly once you get into email, then email sort of becomes the master key to many of your other accounts, because that allows resets. So a pretty simple one is passwords. Obviously, any sort of website assets that organizations do stand up, regardless of their size, securing those is also pretty essential. So we've seen many incidents lately where those assets have been breached, and we've had things like credit cards exposed, which we had happen in Stratfor just a few months ago, or customer accounts exposed as well. And often that's happening from very, very simple little practices that aren't done properly. So little SQL injection flaws, for example, which expose databases is a very, very common one. But the thing as well, Robert, is, you know, we talk about small to medium businesses. This is happening with some pretty large businesses as well. So Sony was very much in the news last year on many, many fronts. Citibank in the UK, same sort of deal. So it's no wonder when you see organizations of that size who do have dedicated security teams and chief security officers, when those guys are getting exposed, it's no wonder that little guys do as well.
Well, I think you need to look at the commonality between it is obviously that there are people involved.
Absolutely.
That's where the whole system, you know, to an extent, is the weakest link, I suppose, to be nice about it. So, for example, let's look at passwords. I mean, what's your recommendation on passwords? And I mean, I've got certainly opinions, but I'd be interested to see what you would say. Someone comes to you, you know, small to medium business, as we've described, and they say, right, you know, we want to set a password policy in inverted commas. What's your recommendation for them?
Look, I'm a bit outspoken on the password front, and I think passwords can be a little bit of one of those sort of religious debates. So, look, my position on passwords is that I think everybody agrees that passwords, A, need to be unique. There's no arguing about that. And B, need to have a fairly high degree of entropy. So we need to try and keep them reasonably long. We need to keep them reasonably random. Now, the problem, of course, is that all of us have so many passwords these days. I know by looking at my password manager, which we'll come back to in a moment, I've got something like 180 different accounts on the web. And it's just everything from I wanted to buy some things at a shop and I had to sign up and get a password to obviously my banking and my email. And particularly working in IT, we all get a lot of extra passwords because we're managing servers or we have other services and things that we need to deploy to. So we get a lot of accounts. Now, we can't make them all unique and we can't make them all strong and remember them. So we have to find some sort of middle ground here. And to my mind, that middle ground is using a password manager. So there are some very good password managers. I use 1Password personally, but there are other password managers like LastPass, for example. And the MO of all of these password managers is let's put all your bags and all your eggs in one basket and let's try and protect those eggs as best we can. So they use very strong cryptographic schemes. They use very strong keys. They try and keep those password keys stored nice and safe. So a piece of software like 1Password, for example, will keep that on your local machine and synchronize it via Dropbox. So I think if we're going to, as organizations, implement password policies that require length and uniqueness, and we're going to end up with a lot of them, we really need to enable people to remember those, or rather record those, in a practical fashion. So I'd like to see something like 1Password or an equivalent rolled out to organizations that do want to implement good, strong password policies.
So, I mean, again, let's tie you down a bit here. If, you know, we obviously the password manager is the way to go because it makes the things easy and auto-generates a nice secure password. But if we have to rely on an individual and they come to you and say, look, you know, I just want to, what's a good password policy, as in, you know, upper and lower case, how long, that sort of thing. Do you have any recommendations on that front?
Look, I mean, obviously the longer and the more random and the crazier, the better. But there's a usability aspect there because the reality of it is people are still going to want to remember some of them. So it's pretty common to see about a minimum of 8 characters, one alphanumeric character, or one non-alphanumeric character, and an uppercase and a lowercase. So that's a pretty sort of standard bar to begin with. Of course, the problem is that doesn't stop you from using password 01 exclamation mark with a capital P, which is obviously not where we want to be. The other problem is that that doesn't stop you reusing them across independent systems. So obviously where we've got any sort of federated authentication service like Active Directory, that's fine. We'll have one account and that's all we need to worry about. But the reality of it is we seem to end up having to have multiple accounts even within one organization anyway.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a couple of schools of thought here. One is obviously that, you know, you don't use passwords, you use passphrases. You know, make them sentences and upper and lower case and punctuation, but make it in a human way that it can be remembered. Another one that I've heard recently is the fact that if you just append a string of common characters at the end, so for example, if you use the word password, but then say put in five full stops or 12345 or, you know, just something to add extra entropy, make it longer, because at the end of the day, when a password fails, the only thing that's returned to somebody who's trying to breach that system is, you know, obviously wrong password. So the longer you make it, even if you tend to use, you know, repeating characters or a set of characters that, that are well known to you, that does increase the entropy and make it more difficult. So it's very difficult because at the end of the day, it comes down to the person, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, and, you know, that's also where it gets a little bit religious, so that the passphrases are one popular way of doing things. But the problem, again, and let's even tone it down a bit, you know, 180 accounts that I have is probably a bit excessive. But if you have 20 accounts, can you uniquely remember which passphrases belong to each one? The other problem as well, and this really falls squarely on the organizations and the developers, is that there are a lot of sites that make it extremely difficult to have strong passwords. So, for example, I can't log on to my Qantas frequent flyer account unless I have a four-digit PIN. So there's no password. There's my frequent flyer number, which is clearly visible on my luggage tag. So certainly that would not be considered a secret. And then there's four numbers. IMB Bank has been a similar deal. I think they've got about six digits. So now we're actually talking about extremely low degrees of entropy. And those organizations, and I have actually asked these organizations, hey, guys, why are you doing this? You know, we're trying to encourage a good password practice here. And they'll say, well, yes, but we've got all these other mitigations in place and we've got fraud protection this and, you know, well, you need this other piece of data, et cetera. But, of course, the problem is that it starts to sort of undermine this message that we're trying to give about let's give people the opportunity to make their passwords as strong as they like. So one thing that I'm, you know, very worried about is any sort of restrictions that limit people's ability to create strong passwords when they want to do so with the best of intentions.
Well, I think, again, it's an interesting analogy, isn't it? I mean, you know, most people would think, would consider that their banking details or their access to their ATM is the most important thing that they want to secure. And typically for most people, that's only secured by, you know, a card and a four-digit number. So in this world that you see a lot of cases where people go up to a petrol Bowser and they swipe their card and they punch in their four-digit number and put in the petrol and off they go. But again, they sort of make that available to everybody who's within view. The other issue then is obviously on an ATM machine is, think about it, you know, the reality is the keypad's always in the same place, so you don't necessarily have to see what numbers they're pressing. You just have to see whereabouts in the block of nine or whatever that they're actually typing. So again, you know, it's a relative thing that something as simple as that can be broken or can be compromised by someone looking over your shoulder. So very interesting.
Yeah, I guess the mitigation with the ATM example, though, is that it really is two-factor authentication. So you have to have the card and you have to have the PIN. So, you know, there is a valid argument to be mounted there, particularly when there's a usability aspect. You know, you're standing at an ATM, you've got to sort of punch in some characters. You can't make it 20 crazy characters. You know, I can understand that. That's a harder breach. Now, the problem, of course, is that doesn't necessarily mean authentication mechanism needs to translate through to a medium like the internet when you're at a keyboard. And certainly one of the counter arguments that I've had from companies before is I've said, well, look, we want to be able to create one mechanism that works at the ATM, on the phone, and at the keyboard. And of course, the risk with that is that you're lowering everything to the lowest common denominator. So your internet, which has this massive attack surface with billions of people using it, has the same, I guess, access controls as if you have a card in your possession and you're able to stand at a machine monitored by video cameras. You know, it's quite a different paradigm.
Well, I think also, too, the issue then, especially in the service station example, is, well, you're carrying the card, so you put the number in and it's, you know, you've got the card with you. The person, you know, who potentially wants to take it from you knows that you've got the card and seen you punch the number in. So, yeah, look, again, it's all relative, I agree. But, you know, obviously the more factors of authentication that you have, the better it is, because, you know, it's something you have, something you know, and maybe something you are. So have you had any feedback on something like the Google Authenticator?
Yeah, so certainly adding factors of authentication is always going to be a positive thing. And I think at the very least, adding the option to have a second factor of authentication. So, you know, Google making that available, other organizations making a second factor of authentication available. And very often, it'll simply be, hey, we're going to SMS you a PIN number. Fine. That's a great option to add on top of your existing authentication. There's something you are when we start talking about biometrics. That's a very interesting one. I would love to see that develop into something feasible and practical. I don't think we're going to see that for a while, though. Certainly not in terms of how we authenticate to websites.
Yeah, I think one of the classic examples is in Mythbusters, they put a key lock that was, in theory, run by a thumbprint. And they were able to defeat it just by a photocopy of a fingerprint. So, again, the stuff you see in movies is probably far from the reality, and I think there's a usability factor involved. So if you look at, I agree that, people's eyes and people's voice patterns are unique, but they can change, obviously, if they're sick or if they have some problem with their eyes or something. So, again, it's a hard one to solve, and how to do it universally and, I suppose, do it in an economic way. Is going to be the biggest challenge for the larger organisations.
Yeah, and the interesting thing there is that every time security takes a step forward, the guys trying to defeat the security take a step forward. So there are always these workarounds. The Mythbuster one is a good example. We've all seen the likes of Mission Impossible Fiction, but there's some really interesting examples out there of people doing things like using gummy bears to sort of recreate thumbprints that possibly don't have a dependency on temperature or thermal attributes or other really unique, simplistic circumvention mechanisms. So I think the one thing we can be sure of is that as security moves forward, particularly with different factors of authentication, we're going to see those exploits move forward as well. And it's going to be a continual game of catch up for both parties.
Yeah, I think that's the other side of the coin. I mean, unfortunately, it's going to be a never ending game. And that's what makes it particularly hard. So sort of to draw it back to our initial point here, what are the sort of things that a small business, can do to help protect themselves? We talked about passwords as being the most obvious. How often do you recommend they change those passwords? I mean, people are always against changing them, but, do you make them super long and never change them? Or do you think it's a good idea to keep changing them? And, then beyond the password, what are some other basics that people can look at implementing to make sure that, they're as secure as possible?
Yeah, well, of course, we're talking very generically here as well. And I think the reality of it is that different assets are probably going to end up requiring different policies, at least in terms of a recycle rate. So obviously, it's a very normal practice for most organizations to recycle things like Active Directory passwords and to keep a running history as well, to ensure that passwords aren't reused within any sort of frequent period of time. So I think that works fine for something like Active Directory, which, again, are sort of the keys to your kingdom. I mean, that's your email, that's your access to all your apps, it's probably your payroll, things like that as well. When we do get to those more autonomous systems, which maybe protect assets of lower value or single assets, it's pretty rare to start seeing password recycle policies. So if we think about banking services that we use or other web applications, even our email, if you're talking about the likes of, say, Gmail or Hotmail, we don't tend to see those recycle policies. So I think it's got to be an appropriate use case. But while we're on passwords and we're talking about protecting organizations as well, I guess the other thing that's very important here is where organizations are implementing software that manage passwords, to use a proper cryptographic hashing scheme and to use a cryptographically random salt. So never, ever, ever, ever store them in plain text and never, ever, ever store them as direct hashes. And they're two mistakes that we see frequently bringing companies undone.
So probably what you need to do here is to, for those people who may not understand what they are, so if you can just give us, I suppose, a brief understanding of what a salt is and obviously what a hash is in when it comes to cryptography.
Yeah, so look, probably the right place to start here is with a hash. So a hash is a one-way deterministic function. So it means that if we take a piece of a string of text and we fire it into a hashing algorithm, we will get an output which we cannot reverse. So we cannot take a hash or a ciphertext that's the result of a hash and play it back in reverse. So it's one way. Now, the other thing I mentioned there is it's deterministic. So you can take a piece of string and apply a particular hashing algorithm to it, and I can do the same thing in a totally different location, the other side of the world. And so long as we're using the same algorithm, we get the same result. So what that means for passwords is that if we can hash a password and we can store the hash in the database, then if somebody breaches that database and they get the passwords, all they've got is hashes and they can't reverse the process. Now, the way that works with logging on is when you go to a logon form, you enter your username and your password, and the system then says, okay, let me grab that username record out of the database, and I'm going to look at the hash in the database, and then I'm going to hash the password they just entered. And if they match, then that's fantastic, they can log on. Now, all of this is fine theory, and a lot of people do implement their systems like that. Now, the problem, of course, is that because hashing is deterministic, once a hash has been quote unquote broken, you've sort of broken every single hash out there. So for example, we know that as unfortunate as it is, many people use the word password for their password. Now, we can look at a couple of the most common hashing algorithms and immediately know what is the hash that that password creates when it goes through the algorithm. So what that means is hackers end up with a couple of different means to break hashed passwords. So one means is what they call a rainbow table. And what a rainbow table does is it enumerates through a huge range of potential passwords. So it might say, give me everything between 6 and 10 characters, all lowercase. And that would cover a very large majority of passwords, percentage-wise. And go and pre-compute all the hashes. Now, when somebody's database gets breached, I'm going to take that database and I'm going to feed all the hashes into my rainbow table software, and it's going to come back and say, well, this hash is actually this plain text version. So there's a predictability risk there. The other thing they do is they use Google. And Google is an amazing password cracking engine because there are literally millions and millions and millions of passwords, hashes, and their plain text equivalents out there on the net. So if your database is breached, a lot of the time, it's just a matter of taking one of those hashes and feeding it into Google and, hey, here's your result, because inevitably somebody somewhere has used that password before. So that's hashing and the problem with hashing. So what assault is assault gives us a degree of randomness. So assault is a cryptographically random string. So it might be a bunch of bytes which get added to the password and then it gets hashed. Now, what happens then is your hashed password and the salt are stored in the database. So when someone actually creates their account, you're giving them a password. The password then has a totally random salt, and all of that gets hashed together and put in the database. Now, everybody gets their own random salt. So when someone logs on, we're just replaying that process. Now, the reason why this gives us protection is because it means that every hash has got a huge degree of randomness. And if you wanted to take someone's database that's got 1,000 passwords in it, you would have to go through and come up with literally every possible password within a particular range, add the salt from the database, hash that, and then see if it matches what's stored in the record. Now, all of this is about trying to make it continually computationally expensive to break passwords. So it doesn't make it impossible, but as opposed to a rainbow table where you could get the plain text equivalent of thousands of hashes in the space of a few minutes, you're now talking about huge amounts of time just to break one password. So I know that was a very long explanation, but the key takeaway there is use a strong hashing algorithm and use a cryptographically random salt.
So obviously they're terms that, yeah, look, they're great and you know, we should do that. But at the end of the day, if I'm an end user or I'm someone who's not a cryptographer, how do I know that what I'm using does that, you know, uses those sort of techniques to protect my information?
Well, the one way you know for sure is that if you are ever sent your password by a website, such as a password reminder, then it is not using any sort of hashing at all, regardless of even salting, simply because it is impossible without some sort of brute force attempt to take that hash and convert it back to plain text. So if you go to one of those sites and you say, oh man, I've forgotten my password, okay, I'll enter my username and it will email it to me, and that email comes in plain text, they are either storing it in plain text or they're storing it encrypted rather than hashed, And whilst that's certainly better than plain text, storing it as encrypted has its own problems, because if somebody does take ownership of the machine and is able to replay the decryption process, well, then those accounts get exposed again.
So I think, again, it harkens back to using a tool or maintaining a unique password for, you know, all these systems, which obviously is a significant pain in the backside. But again, one thing that you can do is maintain a unique store of passwords. And unfortunately, the human brain does have a limit of how many it can hold. So again, this is where these third-party tools and apps come in. So you would be generally recommending that most users implement that sort of scheme, some sort of, you know, password vault, if you want to store that.
Yeah, and look, I think it's the best mousetrap that we've got at the moment, Robert. It's certainly not perfect. It certainly has its own risks. And the one that most opponents, I guess, call out is the fact that you are putting all your eggs in one basket. And if the one master password that you use as the key to that is exposed, and obviously the encrypted file is exposed, then you've got problems. But it is actually a very practical way of working. It's obviously the way I work. I've gotten other people working that way, including my parents, who are probably not as tech savvy as most people. And the neat thing about something like 1Password is it integrates with the browser. So I can go to a website that I want to log on to, that I have an account, and I click a little key in the toolbar and I type my password and it logs me in. So even from a usability perspective, it's actually a really nice little tool to have. Now, interestingly, I do see that there looks like there might be some things on the roadmap for Google Chrome with this as well. And I'm a little bit surprised that the browser vendors sort of haven't taken more steps in this direction. But I think we might see that in the near future.
Yeah, it's interesting because I haven't seen 1Password. I'm just having a quick look at it on the net now. But the preferred one that I always recommend to people is LastPass. It does the same sort of thing and integrates and basically encrypts before it sends up to LastPass. It doesn't actually store any of your passwords, like I said, in plain text or encrypted. It's all basically done locally and then sent up. And the good thing I found with LastPass is also it can do the auto generation of the passwords as well. So there's plenty of tools out there that do it. And again, LastPass, and by the look of it, 1Password also works across multiple platforms. So, you know, very handy.
Yeah, and, you know, that's important too. And LastPass is certainly very popular and would be highly recommended as well. But, you know, for both of them, that they do have the advantage of being able to work across, say, your iPhone, because it's no good having these super-duper long passwords that you can use when you're sitting at your PC and then you go mobile and suddenly I can't log on to do fundamental things. So being cross-platform compatible is extremely important.
Does 1Password support Google Authenticator?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, so the one big advantage I see of LastPass is that now supports Google Authenticator. So what that means is that you install 1LastPass on your system and it integrates with your browser. When you go to a website, it will remember your password and put it in for you. But it also can do that when the browser launches, you're asked to put in a Google Authenticator number. Google Authenticator is a little app that sits on your iDevice or on your mobile device, and then can generate a 4-digit PIN code which you put into LastPass to authenticate you, and then basically open up your password vault once you have also put in a password. So again, two-factor authentication to me gives LastPass that little bit of extra security, I think, over most other apps at this stage.
Yeah, now someone from 1Password may well now call me and tell me I'm completely wrong, and they may be right, but I guess having not used Google Authenticator before, that's not something I've checked. But, you know, I think the important thing is that all of these password management systems and the big guys like Google are heading in the right direction with this. They're trying to make it easier to have strong passwords and where possible to use a second factor of authentication. And to be honest, all of that is pretty good in my book.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, it's all about pain. Obviously, you know, the more pain it is to put your password in and to go through a couple of hoops, and obviously it's going to be more difficult for someone else trying to break into the system. So it's, you know, an analogy to a, you know, if you've got two sorts of cars parked next to each other, the one that's going to be taken is the one that's left unlocked and has no alarm and all that sort of stuff. So again, having things like a club lock and an alarm and insurance doesn't necessarily mean that your system won't be stolen, but it certainly reduces the chances of that happening.
I think that's a pretty common theme with security as well. We're trying to make things as secure as we can without upsetting people too much, you know, the legitimate people. So that even goes to things like session timeouts. You know, should we try and force people to re-authenticate in a shorter amount of time, therefore limiting the window opportunity for someone to break in? But then we upset them because they're in the middle of doing their banking and they went to get a cup of tea and now they've got to start again. So there's sort of this perpetual trade-off. And of course, the reality of it is we're always just trying to make it just that little bit too hard for the bad guys. I don't think we're ever sort of reaching this point of, okay, now I'm impenetrable and nobody will get through it, because, you know, given enough time, enough money and enough intelligence, I think anything's going to be vulnerable. But it's trying to just make it that little bit too hard.
Yeah, no, look, I think you know exactly that. It's a matter of just making it, you know, a little bit tougher than average. And, you know, most people who want to breach security systems aren't going to sit there and generally run through massive encryption trying to get to you. They're going to look for an easier target, and it comes back to the old Wi-Fi. You know, if there's a number of different Wi-Fi systems out there, the one that's going to be attacked generally is the one that's open or has a very poor encryption encryption use. So, again, make it a little bit tougher, and again that moves you up the chain to make it more difficult for someone to get in. So again, so we've got our obviously our decent passwords, we've got our password add-in, our password vault, which there are plenty of options around to do that. What else would you generally suggest that people look at doing?
Well, look, another good option, and we're getting back to my domain here around web applications, is look at using some of the dynamic analysis tools for security. So what I mean by that is using a tool, for example, there's a very good tool called NetSparker, and NetSparker runs on the client. You give it the URL of a website and it goes through and tries to break it in all sorts of different ways. So it'll go through and try to execute SQL injection and see if there's cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. And what I like about a tool like this is it's pretty much a matter of install it, give it a URL, and let it run free. When that tool goes through and analyzes the website, and it can take quite a while depending on the site, you get a really nice report back with lots of colors and easy to read things and, you know, very sort of layman's terms about, hey, here's where your problems might be. So I think it's sort of a very, very low bar for people to get in and actually do a little bit of security analysis.
So what you're doing, what you're saying is perhaps, you know, download that tool and point it at, you know, some of their, you know, internal systems from outside. Is that what you sort of suggest?
Well, you can point it at any URL. So If you have your own publicly facing website, and this is also the danger as well. I mean, you can point this thing at anybody's website. But that's also sort of the beauty of it in terms of usability. So if you have got a corporate website which is facing the world, download this tool, put in the URL and give it a run. So there's a free community edition that will do a little bit, and then you pay a little bit of money and you get a commercial tool that does a lot. But either way, the bar to using it is extremely low, and I think it's a worthwhile accompaniment to all your other checks and balances for websites.
Okay, so I mean, we've got some basic stuff from the user's point of view. Obviously, I think another one is obviously making sure that all their systems and their software are up to date, and that's becoming more difficult, obviously, with more and more applications that are out there. One of the tools that I like is Secunia. I don't know if you've used that. That basically goes around and checks that you've got the latest version and something that hasn't been discontinued. I mean, do you have any feedback on Secunia as an option?
Look, I haven't used it myself, but I think the point you make there about checking everything's latest version, certainly one thing that I think any organization needs to be very conscious of is that things like frameworks are very frequently updated, and they're very frequently updated with security updates. So obviously we're all familiar with taking Windows updates and service packs and patches to plug specific holes. It's the same for any application, be that a web app or a client app internally. So having a process to be able to react quickly, I think, is a really critical aspect of security. And that might mean reacting quickly in terms of deployment to desktops. That might mean reacting quickly in terms of your ability to build and deploy an application used by your customers.
All right. So let's turn this a little bit, the technical side of this, spin our propellers a little bit more now. So what would you say if we're looking at, you know, the reseller? So we've typically in an SMB space, we have a reseller, who is doing managed services or, you know, looking after the client's computers, obviously fixing anything that breaks, but typically part of that requires that they also maintain and keep the security current. Obviously the Windows updates we've talked about, and automating that and trying to make sure that they're all done as best as possible. But what other things should a provider be looking to do or looking to be checking in a network to make sure that they are maintaining security for their client, do you think?
So we're starting to get a little bit more on the IT side of things now, and I think sort of the big things that stand out to me are obviously things like making sure that access to ports and protocols is as limited as possible, whether that be internally or at your network perimeter via firewalls. So that's an important one. Clearly, the ability to run and execute at a higher privilege. So depending on your version of Windows, that's managed in different ways. But we know that a lot of vulnerabilities are getting into networks simply because somebody's gone off to a website, clicked a button, and they've installed themselves a piece of malware. I think also trying to treat the internal network as though it were public to begin with, in terms of let's not start making assumptions that just because we're behind the firewall, we can't have direct access from bad guys via any sorts of number of means. So I think there is a little bit of complacency that tends to go on when something sits behind the firewall, and we need to try and get over that as well.
Okay, so here's another common question that I see, well, that's, you know, in this space. As you can appreciate, there are a number of different firewall products. So traditionally, you're going to see a product from a vendor like D-Link, Netgear, Linksys, providing ADSL connectivity, but also incorporating, you know, a firewall. Now, is that sort of device, which is, you know, sub $100 as a firewall device, is that adequate? Or should they be looking at the next tier, the $600-$700,000 dedicated firewall device, which obviously does has a lot more features, but at a functional level, it is a basic modem, router, firewall that you can pick up from the local electronics store good enough to protect a small to medium network, in your opinion?
Wow, good question. So we're getting very much out of the application space and into the IT space here, but to sort of put myself in that position, I would frankly be a little bit concerned about buying any sort of network product in the hundreds of dollars that I think at that figure is probably orientated towards the home user, and then trying to protect even a small business network from that, where you're going to have a very different sort of risk profile. You're going to have very different activities going on behind that firewall. That would be a little bit of a red flag to me, and I would be looking at a product that is more orientated towards the style of business that you're working in.
Yeah, but I think at a fundamental level, is the cost of the product, having something that's a little bit more expensive and obviously upmarket, is it really just additional features they're selling with that product? Isn't a firewall a firewall? It's just blocking ports?
Yeah, well, I think if that was the case, there'd probably be a lot of big guys going out of business as well. Look, again, we're sort of starting to get a little bit out of the area I'm most familiar with, but I just see the use cases of what you would have in a personal firewall / router is a very, very different model to what you'd have in a corporate environment. The ability to control and restrict ports, so you'd want to have a lot more control over in that corporate environment. The ability to let particular services run through that. And I think also the active protection and the reporting of the nasties that might be trying to get in from the other side as well, you'd probably take quite a different profile on that in a corporate environment. And I know that the sort of the equipment that I run at home would not give me anywhere near the sort of visibility or protection that I'd want to have if I was actually running a business from behind it.
That's fair enough. I mean, it's just, it's one of those perpetual arguments that, you know, it seems to make sense, but some of the devices can get very expensive, and it's a case of, well, exactly what do you get money? I think it's a business decision. I tend to agree with you that obviously if you're going for the cheapest solution, you get what you pay for. So something to be aware of, but you do see a lot of people ask as to, well, you know, what really is the fundamental difference?
I think it's probably a bit of a law of diminishing returns as well. You start having to spend a whole lot more money to get a little bit of extra features. But look, I, to be honest, I'd be the first guy to say get some dedicated network advice on this, you know, not necessarily paid for, but at least look at some of the resources that are out there. Maybe look at some of the community members that can help you with a question like that. But yeah, it's a little bit hard for me to say as the application guy.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I just, again, it's good to get different opinions on that sort of feature, which is, again, something that's a common question in this sort of space. So I'll bring it back to the application level for you, where you're most comfortable now that we've moved you out of that zone temporarily. Do you want to give people a bit of an indication or an explanation around what an SQL injection attack is? I mean, it's something that we've heard, something we've talked about. SQL databases are very common in many respects on the web. What is it basically? What's involved in an SQL injection attack?
Well, I guess to begin with, when we talk about injection, we most commonly talk about SQL, but it need not only be SQL. So we could have an injection attack in LDAP, for example. Now, basically, the way these injection attacks work is they're trying to manipulate the normal flow of the query. So if we take something like SQL Server, we might have a simple example of select star from user where username equals, and then there's a parameter that's passed in for that username. And developers do this simply because obviously that's going to execute under many different contexts. Now, a SQL injection attack happens where when we pass that user parameter, we're able to do so in such a way that not only do we pass the data, but we're actually able to pass some new instructions to the query. So what this normally means is that that particular value has not been what we call parameterized. So it's actually being appended to the string. So before SQL Server actually gets its hands on the query and knows that there's a query component and there are parameter components, something upstream, which is normally happening at the web layer, so at the, you know, the .NET website, for example, someone said, okay, well, look, let's just whack all this together as a string, and then we're going to take whatever that username value is and concatenate it. So, for example, someone might say, okay, well, look, I'm going to type in my username, but then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little statement after it, and I'm going to say something like or 1 equals 1. Now, if we appended that to our select star from user, that would then actually add another condition to the query, and that condition would always hold true. So they're actually starting to manipulate the execution of the query. Now, that's a fairly benign sort of query. Well, actually, it's not too benign because you could log in as anyone using that logic. But where it starts to get a little bit more aggressive is, okay, well, what if we did that and then we terminated that SQL statement with the semicolon? And then we actually wrote a new one, and we wrote a new statement to do something like delete all the records from a table or update the records so that we could inject some cross-site scripting into your products page. And that's basically what this SQL vulnerability is, this SQL injection, getting your query to do unintentional things by manipulating the parameters.
Okay, so again, there's probably not a lot you can do in that case. It's going to be something that's going to be, you know, some website you use that may be subject to that sort of attack typically. I mean, I wouldn't think that most businesses would see that themselves. It's obviously something if they've developed their own application. I mean, would that be true?
Well, yeah, so it's the sort of thing where as an end user, you normally don't have visibility to how that application is handling the data. So it's very hard to tell if there's a SQL injection vulnerability unless you start messing around with parameters. As a business, if that is your web application, then you know the potential ramifications for that are obviously pretty dire. But again, something like SQL injection is the kind of thing that one of these automated tools will pick up in an absolute snap. So they're also not difficult vulnerabilities to find, but it's very easy for people to have implemented them on the development level.
Okay, so I mean there's a good example of something that is quite common and to be aware of, and again, you know, updating it and making sure the application's written appropriately and tested and all that sort of stuff. So as we're getting towards the end of our time, what I might do, do you have any I suppose, feedback or experience on the mobile app side of things, you know, things for the iPad, the iPhone, Windows Phone, Android. I mean, is that, are we seeing the vulnerabilities in there? Because that's a nice target and, you know, people are just putting in these $1 apps without thinking.
Yeah, so that's where it gets really interesting. And I think particularly this year, as mobile is just becoming so prevalent, we're going to see a lot more of this. So there are, it's interesting because there are sort of a number of different fronts where mobile devices or mobile apps become vulnerable. So obviously, one of those fronts is, well, you know, yes, we could see malware or other nasties in the app itself actually loaded onto the devices. And that's something which, unfortunately, Android seems to be a little bit more susceptible to, given the way their app store runs. But the other side of it, which is also very interesting, and we're seeing this a lot, is the prevalence of vulnerabilities in the services that mobile devices talk to. So many of your mobile applications need to talk to a web server somewhere because they either log you in or they pull data back from there. And what we're very often seeing is that those web services are really poorly secured. So either those web services are transferring sensitive data around without any encryption, so they're not using HTTPS, or those web servers are exposing way too much information, which may not be shown on the actual device, but you can very easily look at by proxying the requests through a proxy like Fiddler. And those sort of vulnerabilities are becoming very, very prevalent because they're sort of a little bit out of sight. So as a consumer, you can't see it. There's very little you can do to mess around with an app on the device. It's not like a web application where you start changing, you know, the URL parameters or things like that. But it's very, very easy for, I guess, people that are a little bit nosy, like myself, to have a look at the data that's actually being sent back and forth over HTTP. And there's a lot of risks in these apps.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's something to be aware of, and it's, you know, the difference between, you know, in theory an iPhone, which has, in theory, a better approval process versus Android, which is a bit more Wild West, potentially. I mean, both obviously slip through. So, again, something to be aware of, that security is obviously not just a PC, not just a server. It's now your mobile device, which is potentially carrying a huge amount of information that you're custodian of from other people, but potentially also you're doing internet banking, you do other bits and pieces on that device. So again, something to well be aware of. I think perhaps what I might finish off with, Troy, is for most people, their experience with security is what they see in the media, what they read on websites, what they hear other people talking about. What's your general feeling about the way that security is reported? I mean, is it a case of it's generally a Chicken Little situation where it becomes so bad that suddenly everybody's running around with their heads chopped off? Or is it something that's not talked about? How do users actually go and find, you know, relevant, appropriate and, you know, correct security in information rather than stuff like, you know, the sky is going to fall down? So, I mean, I suppose an example, if you want to look at it, is the recent issue with Google no longer checking revocation of SSL certificates. Some people say good, some people say bad, some people scream that I'll never use Chrome because of it. As an end user, what do I do? Who do I believe? I mean, what's your sort of feeling on that?
Look, I mean, it's a hard one. You could ask that question about so many aspects of life, couldn't you? I mean, geez, politics or something like that. And there's always going to be a bunch of different opinions on it. And I think that the media does like to latch onto this sort of stuff, particularly if they can latch onto something that's a little bit, a little bit, outside of our social norms or something that's going to make headlines. So I'd always be a little bit cautious about the mainstream media, to be honest. But there are some really good influential security people around that are worth reading that normally have opinions on this sort of thing. So someone like Brian Krebs, who writes KrebsOnSecurity.com, is a very well-renowned writer. And he does actually often appear in Sydney Morning Herald as well. Or someone like Mikko Hipponen, who's the chief research officer at F-Secure. So these sort of guys are sort of the people that I would read and trust opinions from. But I'd certainly be wary of mainstream media, and I'd be a little bit wary about dedicated IT publications as well. I think they do kind of like to sensationalize a little bit. Something like the Google Chrome situation in terms of certificates is a little bit tricky as well, because there are very valid opinions both for and against them wanting to basically strip out their online certification status protocol to check the validity of an SSL certificate. So there are very good arguments why that's a good idea, and there are very good arguments why that's a bad idea. And you know, you're not sort of going to find one authoritative source as to why it needs to be one way or the other. But you know, fortunately, something like that, there's also good information from the sort of people I just mentioned that have very objective analysis of it as well. So unfortunately, Robert, the answer is it's very hard to find one authoritative source, because a lot of this also constitutes opinion.
Well, I think you're right. And I think that's what, again, it makes it so difficult for a lot of people. You know, is this relevant? Is this, you know, the sky's going to fall? Do I have to do it today? Do I have to do it tomorrow? Do I have that software installed? You know, unfortunately, like I said, it becomes a bit of a, can become a bit of a beat up. And again, getting the right information. And even, you know, some resellers I've seen, you know, get caught up in, swept up in the emotion of it and, you know, not do the wrong thing, but potentially worry a client more than it should be. So look, it is very difficult. Common sense obviously needs to prevail. At the end of the day, it's about making sure everything's up to date, and there's a number of ways of doing that. Again, you need to perhaps be aware of the other stuff. But again, I think if we've covered the stuff that we have covered today, if most of that is implemented, then I think you'd be pretty safe and secure in the fact that, you know, your chances are much less than what they would be without those sort of measures. So I think that's probably the takeaway from that. Again, it's a matter of, it's just something that needs to be done on a regular basis, and needs to be done in a way that makes sense to you and your business. And again, it's just something that's continually going to have to be worked on. And I would think you probably agree that, as they say, you know, security is not a destination, it's a journey.
Yeah, I think that's a really good note to get to the end on, actually. Make security part of the process from the beginning. Don't get to the end and think that now it's important, because by then it's too late. And often it's so late that it's happened after something has gone very badly wrong. And unfortunately, it's not sensationalist, but a lot of organizations do actually go out of business from this sort of thing as well. So, you know, try and get those basics in place very early on. And that's sort of the best advice I can give, whether it's applications or networks or anything like that.
Well, I think, like I said, that's excellent. And like I said, it probably is a very good note to end on. And what I'll do is obviously draw us to a close here and take the opportunity to thank Troy for giving us the value of his time and his expertise in these areas. And what's the best way for people to get in contact with you or find more information about what you do and how you do it, Troy?
So I'm on troyhunt.com, and there's a lot of security-related writing on there, whether it be applications or scams or viruses or things like that. I'm also on Twitter, at troyhunt, which is probably the easiest place to get me on. And if you go to either of those, you can find email addresses and things like that as well.
Well, that's excellent. Well, on behalf of all today's listeners, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Troy for his time and the information that he's provided, and hope that in the near future we can get him back on, and when the sky is falling and security is a big issue, we can tap him again to come on and give us a bit of a level-headed approach to what's happening.
Always welcome, Robert.
No problems. Okay, well, I'll just sign off from another episode of the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. Thank you very much for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.